Hey folks, you're listening to a special 9-part series on gender, gender politics, and gender equality. Obviously, you can do what you'd like in terms of how you listen to them, but I've designed these to be listened to in order. Each episode builds on the last one in a logical way. Think of it like you'd think of a book. If you take things out of order, a lot of it is going to be hard to understand or just seem off. So if you've just stumbled into this episode, please go back to the start. Otherwise, thanks for listening to everything in order. Let's get into it. So we started with a definition of what I think of as sort of the core problem, and I gave the example of working through violence and male violence, male physical violence from the traditional perspective and then from a different perspective, and hopefully one of them leads us to more in the way of solutions. Then we got into privilege and the great privilege paradox, and we worked through racism and sexism, or rather we worked through race-based privilege and gender-based privilege. Then because we all love it so much, we explored toxic masculinity.
Yay.
As a rollicking romp.
Mm-hmm.
And then last time around, we meandered around gender separate spaces.
We did. Thank you.
And we explored how they are a very understandable short-term solution that creates a very substantial long-term problem, or rather fails to fix a very substantial long-term problem. And today I would like to fuck the patriarchy, but probably not in the way that most people think of. Okay, so let's how's that for a recap?
That's perfect. Thank you. Super. And it brings me back. I'm like, yes, I'm in. Let's go.
Great.
Yay.
Okay, so let's begin with have you two heard of the patriarchy?
Today?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Good. What do we think that most people think of when they think of the patriarchy? So I'm not saying what do you two think of and how do you think it works. I'm asking, what do you reckon is like the general understanding out there around what the patriarchy is?
I reckon it's the general view is men, bad. Men have everything, ruling everything. That's super bad. Or super good, depending on whether you're for or against. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
It's often used as an insult, you know, like it's an insult term in most of the places that I hear it.
Yeah. Yeah, I reckon it's those things for sure. I reckon it's the sense that men or male-presenting people tend to control most institutions and tend to have easy elevated access or exclusive access to positions of power and control. And I think also the assumption that those men then act in a way that is favourable towards men. And so a lot of the suffering that women experience and oppression is the result of men in control. Yeah, that'd men, be my take on it.
Men favouritism.
Yeah, men favouring men, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And pulling in a definition from ChatGPT that says, patriarchy is a social system where men hold primary power and dominate roles in leadership, authority, and decision-making in society, family, and institutions. It often marginalizes women and non-male individuals, perpetuating inequality through cultural, legal, and economic structures that prioritize male privilege and control. Thank you, ChatGPT.
Do you reckon, as a side thought, do you reckon it goes along with a bit of a general sense that when women come into positions of power, or if women were in positions of power, that things would be better in the world?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's obvious. That's obvious, cool. Even to me. No.
Awesome. Well, today then, just to give you a little bit of a roadmap of what's coming up, I would like to explore who exactly the patriarchy is.
Ooh.
I would like to explore what exactly it enforces. I'd like to check to see if we've got any data yet on how women will do when they're in positions of power more. And I'd like to also explore how you too, dear listener, can be a member of the patriarchy if you're not already.
Special members
Okay.
club bonuses.
So you know already how much I like paradoxes. You know already how much I like paradoxes. And back when we were looking at the privilege concept, we got into the privilege paradox a bit, which is like on one level, we all know that male type people are privileged in certain ways, and there's nothing we've said on in any of our discussions or episode which is undoing that. But then the paradox is, well, how come there's all these indicators that suggest that men are not doing so great? So that took us to the privilege paradox. And I'm just kind of like, I'm not going to revisit that territory, but I'm just going to dip into it a second here, and sort of look at some other aspects. Because on the one hand, the patriarchy is in control at the moment. Like most positions are of power and authority and governance are occupied by male presenting folks. And we know that there's that whole sort of section of the world which is more accessible to male presenting folks. So career, finance, governance, political power, voice in public. We know all of that to be true. But at the same time, the paradox is, first point, men are the ones that get conscripted to go to war and either kill or be killed. And that is not to say that women get off scot-free, but yeah, men are the ones that get conscripted to kill or be killed. Next point, in the sort of the social efficiency playoff that happens between sort of in a hetero situation, one partner going off to work and the other partner bringing up family. Most people actually prefer the family option. Most people get to the end of their life and say, gee, I wish I'd spent more time there rather than at work. But in the system we have at the moment, it's men that go off to work. Next point is to prepare men for potentially going to war, but definitely going to work. Men have been conditioned via toxic masculinity, and that hasn't been a huge win for men folk. Next point, men experience about twice as much of almost all forms of violence, including twice as likely to be murdered. Men are about four times as likely to suicide. Men's health and life expectancies are lower. Men make up about 93% of people that are in jail around the world. And implicit bias tests show us that we all collectively really passionately dislike men. So we know that women are structurally screwed over in a whole bunch of ways. We know, yeah, we've explored that some, and I'm not disputing any of that. But I guess I'm just saying, if patriarchy's job is to prioritize the needs and the interests of men, then my God, they're doing a shit job of it.
Yeah, it's definitely falling over a bit there.
Yeah. Be good to get them in for a 3-month review. So that brings us back to the privilege paradox, really. And I guess I want to suggest that something a little different is going on to that general description of patriarchy that I think most people run to. My hunch on the matter is that patriarchy does exist, but it's about 1% of 1% of the population. So I think of a patriarch as being like the elite of the elite, the controllers, royalty, and the super owning class, the people with ludicrous amounts of wealth and ludicrous amounts of power. And my hunch is that the patriarchs care about the patriarchs and they don't care about anyone else. In fact, I would say the patriarchs care about themselves. They probably don't even care about other patriarchs. And I think in general, we as feminists, we as people, we as general members of the public, we assume that because most of those people in positions of power are male, and a lot of those sort of the 1% of the 1% that I've just been talking about are male, we're sort of working to the assumption that they look out for the interests of men. And I guess what I want to say, based on the paradox, is I don't think they care about men any more than anyone else. I think they see men just as cogs in the machine to be used, consumed, and spat out, sent to war, put on minimum wage, sometimes a lot more than that. And I think possibly, and also ironically, those patriarchs are perhaps the ultimate equalitists in that they hate everyone or they're happy to use everyone. I don't think they've got a whole lot of gender bias in their thinking.
Mm-hmm. You just use different people in different ways, different races, different genders.
Yeah.
Different classes.
Yeah.
It all comes back to a needs recognition. You need to be able to recognize the needs of a population, and then you need to care about the needs of that population. So before what I'm seeing you talk about here is we're failing at the hurdle of caring about the needs of others first. But if you care about it, then do we have enough information to actually know what the needs of others are? And that's what I'm seeing is missing. And, you know, that's what we've been talking about in all of these kind of situations, is if you are so stuck at either not caring about people because of their perceived situation that is different than your situation, and then even if you do care about them, you don't have the appropriate resources to figure out what their needs are, because they either can't tell you because they don't know, because they've been conditioned not to have needs or to express them in very different ways. Or, you know, we're actually really crap at knowing the needs of anyone and catering to that anyway. Yeah. Like all of this just snowballs into crapola, really.
Yeah, yeah. If I'm understanding you right, I think we have looked at and focused on the needs of women somewhat in the system, and there's been an assumption that the patriarchy is looking after the needs of men, and we do see some evidence of that. We know that in some ways men are in great positions. Yeah, is that sort of what you mean?
Yeah, and what we're seeing is, you know, when we've talked about the softer skills, what we're actually talking about is more emotional needs. So we see a lot of physical needs met. You know, there's very big houses, there's food at your ears, there's, you know, it's a very excess kind of have stuff kind of thing. But the quality, the things that are connection points, the, you know, looking after people's health, mental health, physical health, those kind of needs aren't being met.
Yeah, and I think we've assumed collectively that because patriarchy is looking after men, we don't even need to bother looking at that because those needs are all taken care of. And I think that's why we've wound up in the paradoxes that I've mentioned, because the evidence doesn't really support that thesis. And I think that if we look exclusively at how women suffer, which for most of the time I think most of feminism has been mostly interested in just that topic, just that side of the equation, and we also assume that patriarchy has a sort of intent about it, it's very easy to understand how we make those assumptions that we've made sort of at the start around what patriarchy is and how women suffer. But, you know, back in the very first episode, I think, or maybe it was in the privilege episode, I said that, in my opinion, intersectional feminism doesn't go far enough. So intersectionality is, just for the listener, is the concept of that we have different things that influence the level of privilege or rank we have in this world, and those different vectors sort of intersect and overlay each other. So the classic example that's generally given is that there is a difference between the suffering of a white woman and the suffering of a black woman. That's where the original notion of intersectionality came from. But I would like to add to that and say that if your understanding of intersectionality doesn't include that if you are male, you're more likely to be a slave than you are to be a patriarch, then your understanding of intersectionality doesn't go far enough, in my opinion.
Fair enough.
I don't know that that's a pretty wild, radical thought for some folks, especially if you've just been thinking in terms of, well, men have got it easy, women suffer. That's going to be a hard one to wrap your head around. So I've devised a sweet, quick little test. No, I haven't devised this. I've stolen this from somewhere else. But anyway, let's move on. If you take a moment, dear listener, to just have like a little bit of a think about the male type people that are around you. So, you know, could be family members, friends, partners, if you're that way inclined, housemates, workmates. And have a think about how many of them feel like they're at that patriarchal ultimate power level of control, and how many of them more feel like they're just sort of cogs in a machine, like the rest of us, just churning through stuff. And I know from experience that when I ask people to have that reflection, a lot of people say, oh, well, it's just an exception for me. You know, I'm in a bubble. Yeah, I've got a few men around me that are actually really suffering really badly for, you know, ways they've been treated and because of the experience of being male in this world. But I'm an exception. But the funny thing is, everyone thinks they're an exception and that they just happen to be surrounded by men that are not exactly patriarchal.
I don't have enough money to run in circles. And I actively avoid circles that have enough money where I may run into somebody who would run those kind of things.
Yeah, well, and you, but my friend.
For reasons.
By globals.
Like we've talked about. So.
Yeah. And I'm just going to go right ahead and guess that you, like me, are probably in the top 1% of the global income scale. And neither you nor I are surrounded by friends that feel like they're at that patriarchal level of power.
No, not at all.
So that's like a perfect case in point. Yeah. Shall I go on, or did either of you have more thoughts at this point?
I've just been thinking about ratios, you know, in terms of if we are thinking of, but there's somebody pulling all the puppet strings and it's a he. Even if that is the case, then it still leaves 99.5 or whatever percent of the world still going, well, yeah, I'm not at the puppet stringing place. I'm not at the top of that gig, regardless of what gender I have or don't. And so the ratio is a kind of, it's almost a moot point.
Yeah.
That there's, I mean, yeah, obviously it's still a relevant and interesting and important point to think about at all, but also the fact that, yeah, most humans on the planet aren't at the top of the scale. We're not making the decisions. We're not making those choices. We're not deciding who, like, even though we have votes, for example, which allegedly does stuff, we still, no one I know is at the top of being able to decide who can have an abortion at what point.
Right.
And obviously there are people in Australia and all different parts of the world who are making those choices, but it's a far smaller bunch of the people. I guess the fact that there are more of the people maybe, and well, actually I said it a fact, maybe it's not a fact. The fact that I think that it's more likely to be more men who are making those choices is still worth looking at, obviously, very, very worth looking at. But that's just what's occurring to me at the moment is these ratios of how many of us aren't in there.
I'm glad you mentioned abortions and who's making decisions, because there's some material coming up in just a little bit of time where we're going to dip into that a little further. So well intuited.
I would like to point out, though, Emma, that's Roger's point, is that, you know, if everybody is assuming that the men or men presenting folk who are those influencers, those people affecting change and being in control, if we're assuming that they're prolific and everywhere and that all men have that status, then that's the problem. When it's recognizing that actually it's this very, very small percent that most of us don't have access to. And that's part of the problem. You can't say, well, you're a man on the outside, so that's it. You control everything.
Yeah. That was also my point.
Yeah, cool. Awesome.
Yeah, love it.
Crazy.
So I'd like to propose that something slightly different is going on, and I think it's something slightly simpler. I think that When the way people sometimes talk about patriarchy, it often actually fits the model of a conspiracy theory, by which I mean that an exclusive club of people have an agenda and influence the rest of the world surreptitiously. That's often the way we speak about the patriarchy, as if
I
there's a
love
real systemic plan there.
it.
Now, I can't rule out that possibility. I just think if that was the case, we'd have seen some leaked minutes or some notes or something by now. Or someone would have met someone from this elite cabal. So at this point in the conversation, most people will slightly adjust the way they start talking about patriarchy and talk in terms of more along the lines of something like structural self-replicating advantages. So still with that assumption that men folk tend to look out for men folk, and we've got a system which biases and prioritizes and benefits men. And there's a self-replicating nature to that, even if it's not intentional. So I think there is some truth in that, for sure, in that the system does keep replicating us and replicating us into our roles. But I want to propose an alternative explanation for how and why that's happening. And I want to sort of use an Occam's razor approach to sort of compare and contrast the two.
Hey, I hope you're enjoying the series. I do this for the love of it, but there is something I'd like your help with. I'd love it if you can share this with someone. At some stage during this series, when someone comes to mind that might be interested, please go right ahead and click the share button. I'm aware that in some circles this can be pretty contentious material, so here's a tip. You don't have to say, "Hey, I love this, you will too." You can just say, "There's some food for thought here," or something similarly ambiguous and non-committal. It's all good. So yeah, at some stage during this series, please share it with someone. Now, back to the content.
So Occam's razor, for those of you that are not like science nerds, is the principle or philosophy or problem solving that suggests that when presented with competing hypotheses or explanations, the simplest one, or the one with the fewest assumptions, is usually the best. So if in other words, if two explanations account for all facts, the one that introduces fewer speculative elements should be preferred. So I've forgotten where I stole that from. I think it was straight off Wikipedia, and I'd like to use that approach to compare and contrast traditional ideas of patriarchy with this approach, which is to say, in the beginning, there was life. Once life had discovered itself, it lifed and it lifed and it lifed and it loved lifing so much that it started splitting and diverging and iterating, and then there was many different species upon the planet. And all of those species and all of those life forms, all of those expressions of life have just been iterating an almost uncountable number of times to just find the strongest strategy to survive. Life is just massively in favor of life, and it has no judgment value over how it gets there. So if you're a tree and it makes sense to grow taller, then you grow taller. If it makes sense to have more fat leaves, then you have more fat leaves, and so forth. Throughout the course of life, running these experiments to see what is most strategically advantageous, just to create more life, because that's the only end game, creating more life. We have now an absolutely bewildering array of options and social structures. So we see like some species have asexual reproduction, so they just reproduce purely by themselves. And of course, some species have sexual reproduction, so it takes oftentimes a male and a female sample from the same species that come together in some ways and then produce little versions of their species. We have social models like bees and ants, where one happens to be female, that's not important for this story, controls the entire community of more or less males, but again, not important. And then we get examples like a lot of spider communities where they've got a model where you fuck and snack. So you fuck someone, then you eat them.
I still feel that should be for humans, but that's all right. I don't mind either way. It's like, that's great.
Yeah.
You always need a snack.
I like a burger and a beer myself after a good fuck, but I mean, I guess that's why I'm human, not spider, right?
Valid.
Do that.
Okay, So there's a huge bewildering array of models out there, and thanks to our particular species, we've recently developed global communication and visibility, and so we're in this amazing spot at the moment where we can see amongst our human species an incredible array of social experiments all running live at the same time, like amazing diversity in culture and community around the globe of how we as humans function. To say nothing about all of the plants and animals that we share the planet with. Albeit in controversial ways. And so burrowing right down into the detail of just in our particular section of the family tree, so looking at sort of, you know, chimps and apes and us as sort of, you know, the branch that we occupy, we have gotten here with a mix of selfishness and pro-social behaviour. So that's not true for all species. Some species are just absolutely selfish, and some of them are absolutely pro-social. They do things for the rest of their species. We are a mix, and even within human colonies or human cultures or human societies, some societies are much more geared around selfish models of behaviour, and some are more geared around pro-social. And what we also have as humans is, for the most part, a specialisation along gender lines, which basically means that in a she cares and he hunts. And it's not just to say within like a hetero relationship. I mean, most human societies are built around women doing more of childcare, nurturing, those sorts of roles, and men going out doing external sort of stuff. These are gross, hideous generalisations, but I don't think there's anything too controversial about what I've just said. You can trace our lineage there, that gender specialisation, you can trace it back very directly to chimps and apes and the like. Great series on Netflix called Chimp Empire, which is I recommend to people just because it's disturbing to watch models of behaviour that are going to be very familiar to you as a human being played out so exquisitely by apes that are in theory, you know, about a million years our junior. It is disturbing. It is great. Anyway, so you can trace a lineage from communities like that where you've got a group of chimps and the male chimps patrol the border, and there's an alpha. Let's call him the patriarch, who's at the top and does tend to have a lot of control. And at all costs, the female members of the community are protected, because from an evolutionary perspective, that's the best way to keep reproducing that iteration. The male folks defending the borders are actually sort of somewhat expendable, and you need to keep the reproducers alive and functioning, although you do need a balance because you need to defend those females, something like that. And then you fast forward to us, and we've got rules like women and children get off the ship first when it's sinking. There's a very direct lineage between, protecting our female folk. It's better for the species. Does it bother you that you're essentially just breeding machines? Because it bothers me a little bit that I'm essentially a disposable warrior.
Yeah, so I think now I'm in the spinster, have to look after other people's kids community, because I lost those parts to do the reproducing. But yes, there's always so much tied up in even that. And this is exactly why, like, it's not a straightforward conversation even with, you know, female friends, because I have very different views on this than they do, and for the reason, very reasons that you're talking about. So it's very pervasive into everything.
So as you've used the word spinster, what a beautiful, horrible word. There is a lot of social pressure upon people, perhaps especially women. I don't know. I'm not making a judgment call there, but that seems plausible. There is a very strong social judgment against women who choose not to have kids. And from an evolutionary perspective, we don't want too many of them around, I guess. Like, perhaps some of that comes through our cultural heritage of, like, historically, it's been good to have none of them. I would actually throw in, by the way, at the moment, while there's an argument to be made that we as a species are actually overpopulated, then there needs to be a spring retention pullback, which is where things like homosexuality and spinsterhood actually serves a really important role. And you see that in a lot of other populations as well. Like when, you can repeat this experiment when mice exceed their available resources over the course of time. I haven't checked this research for a while. It's about 20 years old, but the female mice will develop a hard mucus plug in their vaginas, and the male mice will mostly go homosexual for a period of time up until the population drops back. And so you can see some of those patterns playing out in our human colonies also, as we realize that we might be at the extent of our resources.
Nice. I like it.
Okay, so listening back, I actually realized that the research I was thinking about was something like 40 years old, so I fact-checked myself on that, and you can find that research. However, there is a little confusion and dispute in the scientific community about mice as a specific example, so I put a bit of question mark around that. However, it is still easy to find examples in nature and in biology of species having self-balancing mechanisms in place, once they've consumed the resources that they have available for them. So I think the point still stands.
You also get, still looking at the chimp models, you get a lot of insight into how we do territoriality and how we do insider and outsider issues. So from time to time, people that are not signaling to the community that they are a part of the community, so they're not going out on the hunt, they're not gathering food, they're not having babies or whatever, from time to time, we will make a scapegoat of them by ejecting them to send a strong social message of shame to make sure that everyone stays in line. And if we as individuals can occasionally kick people out of the community of chimps, that secures our spot within. And if you can't see the straight through line towards social media, you're not looking very hard.
You've also just described the black sheep model of a family type. Environment yes. as well, like you don't fit the model we are, you're different. Go away.
Absolutely. So I think we really haven't moved on much at all as a species, and all of these qualities that I've just been describing in chimps can be found in our human cultures, although we are more likely to use technology, lawyers and guns and things like that to achieve our ends. The basic behaviors are really very similar. And I think that the model that we are calling patriarchy, just to sort of circle back around to what we're actually talking about, it's really just a bunch of chimps, but with bigger brains and better laptops.
More guns and lawyers.
More guns and lawyers.
It's quite scary.
Yeah?
Well, scary is not the right word. I feel like it's just a bit sad how incredibly repetitious the whole life cycle, society cycle is.
I feel sad about it. I mean, I sort of feel excited about the evolution and the progress, and I'm ultimately, I guess, I don't know if I go so far as to say optimistic, but I'm hopeful about the ultimate progress we're making. But yeah, no, I feel sad. I feel devastated when I look around me at bullying. I mean, that's just straight out of Chimp Empire. Mm-hmm. And scapegoating and the way we force people to suicide with shame stuff. Yeah, I feel sad. I feel sad.
It's why I don't go outside sometimes, I guess. No.
I mean, for me.
It's safer. Like there are elements of if you don't participate in the group, you make your own tiny little group, or even you don't, but you stay in the healthy limits of maybe I can provide you a little bit of a thing and I get a little bit of a thing, then you can find ways that aren't interacting with that as much, but you're still at the effect of it. There's no way around that. And in some ways it's good.
If you do that, as you've just been describing, you're pushing hard against the general mainstream way of doing things. It's a hard
every
push.
Day.
Yeah.
And every day.
So like from where I sit, I feel like that model sort of explains everything. It explains levels of male violence that we have. It explains toxic masculinity. Like it just toxic masculinity is just male apes at play. And I think it also explains why men are everywhere, but men's issues are almost invisible. And I think it's because the entire system, so I'm talking now about the duality of the patriarchy that we find ourselves in, and I'm also talking about the model that chimps and monkeys find themselves in. If you had men that cared about themselves and had feelings about that, the whole system would collapse. So I think this inheritance, as I'm calling this model our inheritance, and I reckon it like we don't need to get stuck on whether it's a genetic inheritance or a social inheritance, like whether this is the process of breeding and DNA and that influences our behavior, or whether it's a cultural norm. It doesn't matter too much for these purposes, whether listeners agree with me or not. I personally think that things are much more social than genetic. Like for instance, I was in a 10-year hetero relationship, and all it took for us to undo a million years of conditioning was for us to say, you know what? How about I, this is me speaking, how about I stay at home and do the part-time work and the household stuff, and you go out and do the full-time thing? And she went, that sounds fucking awesome. So my proposal is that it doesn't take a million years of genetic conditioning change to undo. Social
No,
stuff is strong, but
no.
you're pushing back against some strong social forces.
Very much, frequently, yeah.
Yeah. But either way, I guess what I want to propose with this whole Occam's razor approach is that there are less assumptions in this idea that we've just inherited this culture and this way of doing things, and it's worked really well for this section of the family tree. Whereas if you compare that to the idea that there is an organized patriarchy, particularly if you think of that in terms of like a secret elitist cabal, there are a lot of assumptions and a lot of things in that that need to be tested and proven. So yeah, I feel like it's obviously true that there is a system in place with incredibly strong biases in it, and all of the patterned and structural observations we've been making over the last 70 years as feminists is true. We know that's not false. But yeah, I think it's because that's the thing that's kept us alive for the entirety of our species' existence. Like, you know, as opposed to a hostile takeover in some relatively recent period by the patriarchy.
No, it's the slow being reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. I mean, it is in part, it has in part shifted the fact that you could have that conversation
Yeah, that's true.
and then be left to do that with, you know, yes, you definitely would have outside comments. I know because I've lived less traditional ways for a long period of time.
Ah, the
For
black sheep comment
instance,
was close to home,
oh,
was
totally. But also,
it?
you know, I've never been the person who cooks or is the major cleaner in when I've cohabitated because I hate it. And people that aren't me that I live with who happen to be male presenting have always cared about it more than me. So, but the flack we still get from that.
A lot has changed in incredibly recent history. If you're looking at our entire section of the family tree, a stunning amount of stuff has changed in the last, you know, 250 years in of the Industrial Revolution amongst the white populations. And probably since the middle of last century, and in very large part, thank you, feminism, our expectations around relationship stuff. So the three of us, I think, have all grown up in a time where we just take it for granted that our intimate relationships, our partner relationships, should include equality, growth, respect, leisure time together, and all of the other things that we come to expect from relationships. This is bizarrely, radically, incredibly new in terms of the family tree. This is the first time that a critical mass of us have been able to look beyond the relationship model as a method to achieve survival or perhaps business, like economics. We've only left that model in the last couple or few hundred years. It's stunningly new.
And what you're seeing is increased resistance to that freedom.
Yeah,
So we're
from.
seeing, if we look at things are getting more pushed to the extremes, being in the middle and being able to float around in there is getting harder and harder. If I look at what's happening in America, for instance, the non-traditional lifestyles in lots of ways and shapes is being demonized and punished and all of that. So as we get more freedom, we get more resistance to that freedom, so that we have that. But I haven't watched Chimp Empire, but I'm imagining if one of the chimps had stepped out of the role that they were meant to do, they would have been harshly put back in their place.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing here, is that step up in, get back in your place.
It is identical. If you don't signal in the right way and do the right things, so if you don't play your role and have kids or go out and fight on the, you know, protect the borders, you get ejected from the group. You don't get servings of meat when animals are killed. You don't get access to the right fruits. You are absolutely punished, sometimes to the point of death, because within those communities, not having someone to return grooming to you means that health issues get out of control and you die. And the group feels so strongly about enforcing cultural norms that they'll happily have you die. And yeah, we do see that as humans.
And yet I've, you know, teaching all these kids all the time at the moment, just recently, just a few days ago, I was asking some year sevens, did they think or expect to be having children? Did they think they would? And there was probably 23 kids in the class, and I think 7 of them. And I was really interested to note that it was 4 boys and 3 girls, all said, "Nah, I don't think so."
Wow.
Whoa, that was a big proportion.
That is new.
That class. And, you know, and this is the sort of northwestern lower class, lower socioeconomic bracket that I'm working with at the moment. And they're all, and it wasn't anything dramatic. It wasn't like, no way. Oh, one kid was no way. But most, the rest of them were like, no, I don't think so. No, I don't want to. Like, and it wasn't like, I reckon when I was at school, I doubt anyone would have said that. Maybe one person in the whole class might have said it. Yeah. I don't know, because I didn't ask them, because it didn't even cross my mind that I wouldn't be having kids.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's been some good stats on that done. But, and I certainly agree very much with a lot of the pushback that we do get for freedoms that we think should be normal. But yeah, I was really fascinated to see that and go, ooh, you know, as you may know, some of you personally, friends of mine will know that I like running little experiments on all these kids I work with. I'm mean like that. I regularly ask all sorts of questions of all the kids I'm working with, and just, you know, to entertain myself, if nothing else. But you know, I'm really fascinated by it, to find out what sort of things are going on. And yeah, they're much happier to exclude each other for the wrong kind of haircut than they are for the choice about not wanting to procreate.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, how things are changing. That is radically new.
Exactly. I felt it was, I was surprised to have that much of a result like that.
All right. I've got a few other random points that kind of, I think, help to tease out this idea around our inheritance versus a strategic background patriarchy model. One of them is, circling around to abortion rights and the idea that men control women's choices. I absolutely agree that it looks like that. However, if you've ever been the male partner of a woman that is contemplating abortion, then you suddenly realize that it's your choices that are being controlled just as much. If the patriarchy was really doing its job, then male partners would get to choose what happens. And maybe there are actually some cultures in the world, as I'd say this out loud, I'm thinking about the fact that there are some cultures where that is probably effectively or exactly the case. To all people stuck in that system, I am so sorry. And again, like, most of my comments and thoughts are limited to the Australian sort of affluent Western country domain. But yeah, if the patriarchy was really doing its job, male partners would get to choose. That would be men controlling women's choices. The way it is at the moment is some stupid inherited model is controlling all of our choices. And I actually think there's a real interesting leverage point here in that if we just realized that everyone's choices are being controlled here, women and men could come together as siblings on this point, unite, as opposed to it being a women's issue and there sort of therefore being a fight between men and women. It doesn't need to be the case. We could all be on the same team and suddenly there'd be 95% of us going, get the fuck out of our decision making. There, rant over.
Hardly.
I'll be interested to see whether that is the next step, though, is that it is a collaborative choice.
I'd be interested.
I mean, it's my logic isn't the same as everyone else's, but it's logical to me that it should at least be a conversation.
I mean, I feel like it's tricky. And this whole question, if you are the male in that system and, like, you get pregnant, and by you I mean the two of you get pregnant, it's because it's uncommon for men to get pregnant, I understand. I'm not a sex educator or anything, but that's my working knowledge. The tables are really tilted. As the male person, you've got much more freedom to just abandon the whole problem. But if you're doing the right thing, and you're making those decisions together and you're approaching it as a partner and taking full responsibility for what's going on. Yeah, it's ironic that you don't get the option to be responsible in that part of the decision making.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a lot more tricky in terms of saying, can you hold this thing for 9 months in your body?
Yeah.
And then we'll figure out if we still like each other and whether I'm going to stick around or not. And meanwhile, it's still stuck in your body physically. So there's a 9 month very difficult space when it's makes sense that it isn't. Shouldn't in my mind be up to anyone except the person whose body it's in. However, I highly believe and think and have done in my world, think it should be very in-depthly and caringly discussed with the other party.
Yeah, and the next major topic we're going to do is around the pay gap and employment economics. And I think that what you're talking about is a crucial part of solving that problem. Mm. Yeah.
I'll just quickly chuck in. It's not anywhere near as much of a thing now, but it certainly regularly used to involve likelihood of death for a woman to go through a full birth, a full carrying of a child. And so that was, it was like, oh, let's have sex, except that it might kill me because if I get pregnant from this, I could end up dead. So that was, it added quite a big layer of intensity to it.
Yeah.
Fun times. All right.
Next strange point to contemplate with regards to these models is the concept of arranged marriages. And I reckon they are just another hangover social experiment that, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, has worked well.
Mm.
And I don't mean that that's a good idea. My God, that is the opposite of what I actually think. But in terms of as a strategy to reproduce the species, it's been effective. Otherwise, it would have died out. That's the nature of these things. But the funny thing about
ultimate blind date.
Yeah. But the funny thing about that is we often talk about them as if that's an anti-women expression of the patriarchy. But that only actually makes sense if you think that men don't care who they're paired with either or something like that, or that it makes no impact on them. So I would say from this model, like, that sucks for everyone in terms of – I mean, occasionally it works out. I'm not saying that no arranged relationships aren't fabulous. There's a lot of double negatives there. But, from my perspective, since I value choice and love and leisure and respect and all of the other things, I don't think they work out well for anyone. And it's absurd that we talk about them like men somehow come out of that as the victors.
I think that's also got that extra ripple on effect because a lot of the time it's the male's family who get the dowry or who get the bonus financially. That's part of, if you look at a lot of the Indian models and a few of the other ones, a lot of that's like, right, the two families choose, oh yes, we will wed our two, your male and your female, and the male's family often would end up getting a big dowry with that as well. So that's,
I think it's pretty mixed. I haven't researched it, having just jumped into this work that we're doing here. I checked it about 10 years ago and it was really quite mixed. Like I remember seeing it as about a 40-60 split. So you're right, there is a bit of a bias one way.
Well, I may well have been also reading things that were just, you know, fuck the patriarchy sort of thing. Yeah. So that may have been focusing on that
yeah.
element.
Yeah, I might, when I'm editing this, I'll either drop in a clarifying comment or something once I've done some research retrospectively.
Good foresight, Rog. So I went to ChatGPT to see if I could get a simple split on, you know, in what percentage of cases is dowry paid to the man or man's family versus the woman or woman's family. And the initial response I got was that a substantial majority goes to the man or man's family. But there was something about the language in the answer that I got that just felt to me like it was more the language of interpretation and opinion rather than factual presentation of information without bias. So I drilled down further and I asked for exact sources, specifically avoiding opinion pieces and interpretive comment. And what came back was very different this time around and is a really good example of why you need to go to the source for data like this and not just look at articles that are published about the data, which are the ones most of us are more likely to see most of the time. And in a future episode of this series, I will talk about how the media cycle just can't or won't publish certain sides of the story. So keep your eyes open for that one. In summary, having done a bit more of a deep dive on the topic, it sort of looks, and, you know, bear in mind this is a long way out of my area of expertise, but to my eyes, it looks like in Asian countries, dowry payments are around 90% more likely to be paid to the man or the man's family. And actually, it's worth noting that the word dowry actually means payment to the man or man's family. However, in African countries, quote, bride price, unquote, payments are around 90% more likely than payments to the man or the man's family. And there's also the concept of what's called indirect dowry, which aside from looking like that happens a lot, I can't get actual information on. But it's kind of like, I don't know, maybe that's a bit like reverse racism or reverse sexism, which is where something goes the opposite way to what it normally goes. So all I could find was that indirect dowry, so that would be if we're defining dowry as meaning payments that go to the man or man's family, then indirect dowry is the other way around. All I could find is that it happens, quote, a lot. And throughout all of this, actual numbers are almost impossible to track down because information on stuff like this is often really private, like it's between the families concerned, or in some cases it's technically outlawed but still common practice. So it's very hard to gather data around. While we're here, if I could just tell an interesting little side story that occurred to me as I was researching this. When I was in Kenya a couple of years ago, I was incredibly lucky to be able to witness and participate in a traditional Nubian wedding, the Nubian community being a community that traces their heritage back, I think, like about 400 years in what is now various countries in Africa. And there were lots of things about that wedding I adored. It was so rich and vibrant and lively and celebratory and emotional compared to, say, most of the Western weddings that I've experienced. And as one of those rituals, there was a moment where essentially we all formed a sort of a queue and took turns to approach the bride and her mother and sort of lift the veil and make a donation, a cash money donation. And this, at least within this community, this is how, I guess you'd call that a bride price payment. That's how it happens. And it's really funny at the time. I was so touched by that ritual and that whole wedding and that whole day. Like I say, I just feel so lucky for having witnessed it. But it's really funny. I didn't feel like I was participating in a potentially really damaging, harmful system. Like at no time during that ritual did I think to myself, oh God, the poor guy, like the poor groom or whatever the language for that is within Nubian culture. That thought never crossed my mind. Yeah, so funny thing to reflect on. Anyway, let's get back to it. Suffice to say, it sort of looks to me like whether I'm just going to call them dowries, whether they're paid more towards the man or the woman's family, it very much to me looks like it's mixed. It very much looks like it's hard to get data on it. My hunch feeling is that it's more often probably paid towards the man or the man's family, but it's really hard to pick to what extent that's just reporting and an inherent bias in that reporting on the numbers or whether that's accurate. But I'm definitely willing to land on saying it's really mixed. It's definitely not just simply one way or the other.
Little side story. I've mentioned this on the podcast once before. In my early 20s, I can admit this now because the statute of limitations has passed, but I harboured an illegal immigrant, a legal refugee into Australia. He was from Iran, and he came over here because his family were going to kill him because he had fallen in love with someone that his family didn't want him to marry. So the only reason I chucked that story in is just by way of saying it, everyone gets fucked over by this stuff.
Yeah, totally agree with that.
Next interesting point. So I think it's true if you look at the patriarchs that are really fucking things up. So I'm talking about, you know, Putin in Russia and what's his name in North Korea. And just if you look at, like, you know, the heads of big oil and those sorts of, like, the 1% of the 1% type characters who are really behaving badly. Sure, almost all of them are male. But at the same time, it's also likely to be men that are killed or jailed for being activists against those characters, or being journalists, or for bringing internet information to information dark spots and putting their lives on the line. Those characters are all much more likely to be male. So if we were under a patriarchal model where the patriarchs were looking out for the needs of men, then that wouldn't be the case. I guess in short, I think, yeah, patriarchy hates everyone with an admirable level of equality, or said differently, they care about themselves and will use and hate everyone else. And I think perhaps also one of the reasons this can be a little bit hard to wrap your head around if you're from the women's side of the world is I think one of the perspective differences is that there is often a collegiality, or perhaps some would say a sisterhood, that exists between women, an assumed level of trust and safety and solidarity. And it is not true for all women about all women all of the time. Absolutely not true. But from situations like keeping an eye out for each other, having a quick gossip in the bathroom toilets and sharing makeup or whatever, and trading stories on who's dateable and who's not, there is a collegiality there, and it's very easy to assume that on the male side of things that there is also a brotherhood, a collegiality. And I think in some ways that is going to be the case. That does exist. These are all gross generalizations. But I think as best I can guess is that over here in the male side of the camp, a lot of the time we hate men as much as you do. and we also have as much assumed trust and respect for women as you do. So I think that's part of what contributes to the idea that we see that men are in control, and so we assume that men are looking out for the needs of men, because perhaps the model we operate in as sisters is that there is some sort of assumed trust and solidarity and linking of arms and looking out for each other. And I guess I just want to plant the seed of saying, I don't know that that actually translates. I think we hate each other over here in the men's world. It's not the whole of the story. It's a gross generalization.
Yeah,
Any thoughts before?
When I hear you saying, you know, we have an assumed, I forgot exactly what you just said just then. It was like we
solidarity,
care for women, basically. Yeah. And watching the young men that I work with, I don't think that's the general view. Again, you know, they're young, so they haven't yeah. matured, but they're interacting
yeah.
With each other and with women who are with girls all the time. And I wouldn't necessarily say that that's what I see.
Yeah, it's a great point, and I don't know how to measure or assess this one. I haven't been able to think of or find any data to support it. I think it is true in my personal life, but yes, I don't know that I'm in a position to extrapolate it out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think we're very awesomely lucky or fortunate or well skilled to be into the sort of bubbles that we're in. But I, yeah, certainly, you know, the young men that I work with are nothing like the men in my life.
I'm going to stand for it just a little moment longer and say I was thinking about, well, walking down the street, but then that's a pretty extreme example. When I walk down the street, I don't get scared of female presenting people, but I do clock male presenting people. I certainly don't have an assumed sense of solidarity and brotherhood and trust, but that's a pretty extreme example. And then I jumped to, if I imagine turning up to like a psychology workshop or something, or a sexuality workshop, or the stuff that I'm likely to go to, if I turn up and it's overwhelmed by men, my response is not to go, yay, this will be good.
Yep. Yeah.
I don't know. It's so hard to extrapolate.
Corporate environments. So corporate environments, when I observe women talking in a corporate environment, women talk about a lot of things and, you know, not just how are they finding work, but, you know, how are you going personally, and, you know, talk about the challenges and, you know, work that out. When I see men gathering, like if we're talking at like drinks or something like that, if I see men and I can overhear them or whatever, it's not the same kind of conversation either.
Right.
So yeah. It's more a jostling and a, you know, where are they going and, you know, stories and stuff, but not, it's not a, how you going, mate? How are you really going? Like, I ask people that because I'm weird, but I don't see that typically in men hanging out with men. I see that more in women hanging out with women, even in corporate. I mean, especially in corporate, it's kind of exacerbates that kind of traditional model in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I'm happy to leave that as open and unproven for the moment. Let's just have it as a thought seed that people can take or leave. All right. So, let's get into the qualities of what it is to be a member of the patriarchy a little more. Will we look at it from the perspective of, like, what are the qualities, like, whoever's on the recruitment board for the patriarchy, like, what are the sort of qualities that they look for in a potential candidate? I think it's, you look for qualities like the ability to put profit ahead of ethics. I think you look for someone who is capable of lying, cheating, and stealing.
Always a fan favorite.
Always. I think you look for someone who's able to scam and manipulate at basically every opportunity. I think you're looking for someone who looks out for themselves first. And I think you're looking for someone that looks out for their gender first. And the great news is, everyone can apply. Because if that isn't a description of all of us, then I don't know what is. And I guess I think that if someone thinks that they are none of those qualities, then that makes them either a liar or lacking in self-awareness, which ironically qualifies them. Yeah, I think we all have those qualities in them, and we all play into a system which is manipulative and coercive and lacks ethics. They're all patriarchal behaviours, and we all do them every day. to varying degrees, but yeah. Another way of looking at that is, I mean, if you think that it, like putting profit before ethics, if you think that's just something that the patriarchy does and that we're all basically innocents, we all every day choose a cheaper product over a more expensive product that is more ethical, more sustainably sourced, more organic, less carbon emitting, etc. We make that judgment call the entire time. We put our personal budget ahead of what's good for the rest of the world. So we all know what it is to have that quality. And I think we all know what it is to prioritize ourselves or our families or those that are immediately around us over the rest of the population. So that's to do that same quality that we've identified in chimps, which is that when they do get a good kill, they share it amongst the people they want to earn favour with, people they care about. So I'd like to circle next to the topic of how things are going to go as women start stepping more into positions of power, unless you two, either of you have got any thoughts for the moment?
Oh, just that when you first said that, when we were like prepping for what we were talking about, I just went, "Oh, Thatcher." Ugh.
Ah.
That was what I was so, yeah. Anyway, well, I'll
And
let you get into your stuff.
again, Emma, funny you should mention that because
Oh,
we're about to talk about her in just a moment.
on, look at
Ah.
me with my little crystal ball.
I'll be interested to see, the women type leaders that you want to talk about, actually. I'm interested.
What do you call a man who's lost all his intelligence?
I don't know what. A widower.
Anything men can do, we can do better.
Anything men can do, we can do too.
Steal scene.
Stop the show.
Fill the seats, SRO. Have a
So,
chat.
there is a theory that when women come into positions of power, they are going to do it better. And I have certainly believed that for most of my life. And I think I wanted it to be true because I wanted change. And I think I also had a bias towards women. I think you see that perspective a lot. Like it's a lot around sort of tantra circles and the goddess movement.
What I mean by that is that in tantra and sexuality circles, you'll often hear the phrase that we are moving from a masculine way of sexuality to a more enlightened, better feminine way of sexuality. That's just another example of the sense of as women come into the world and women come into power, they'll do it better than men.
But I think it's there in almost all of feminism, is that assumption that women would be doing a better job of things. And it's impossible to get conclusive data on this, because to get comprehensive data, you'd have to compare all male leaders and all female leaders, and somehow have a way of checking and assessing, which is hard to find. But there's a few anecdotal things that we can find. So, one of the things I've looked at, responding to your comment earlier, Emma, is around abortion debates. And what we see, particularly in the States, is that decision makers are much more likely to be split along party lines than they are along gender lines. So there is a little bit of a difference between how male and female politicians vote on that topic, but it's much more different between Republicans and Democrats. Classic patriarchy move, that one. Put your group above your ethics. And we can also see it in terms of who's caused sexual harm. And I speak about this because we often talk about sexual assault as something that men do to women. And so there's sort of an assumption that when women have got more power, that's going to be less of an issue. And there is actually some really good data on this, and it's not anywhere near as extreme as we generally talk about it. So there's one really good bit of recent research that's been done on this by the Australian Institute of Criminology. Their sample data was from 5,000 anonymous Australians aged 18 to 45. So 5,000 is not a huge number, but it's also not nothing. And I've also got some questions around methodology, but it was first brought to my attention through by the ABC, which, if anything, has a massively pro-gender pro-women bias. Mm-hmm. The basics of the question, so the basics of the research was asking people in the last 12 months if they had been the perpetrators of sexual harm. And that was defined fairly broadly, like, say, have you coerced, have you manipulated, through to outright rape and assault. And in the last 12 months, the differences were basically 17.7% of women and 26.4% of men. So off the top of my head, that's about one in five or one in six women and about one in four men. So that's not a huge difference in terms of who's causing sexual harm. But given,
do we know with that 5,000 people, was it half female, half male, or we don't know? I mean, and maybe it doesn't matter. I don't know.
And I also don't know how they controlled for self-perception, by which I mean.
I didn't push her. She wanted it.
Oh, more. If you ask that person that question directly, they're going to have a bias towards, of course I didn't. You need to structure the questions in a way which would get you the outcome that you want without making the person feel like a sexual assaulter sometimes. Yes. So, yeah.
The self-perception, I agree with both of those points. The self-perception thing that I'm thinking about is because most of the time when we just talk about sexual harm, it's spoken about as with a male perpetrator and a female victim. In my experience of hosting events, sexuality workshops and so forth, is that a lot of times a female presenting person, or female identified person, will do an act and not think of it as sexual harm, but exactly the same act in a male presenting person will be regarded as harm. So I don't know how this piece of research controlled for that. But I'm guessing to get to those figures, they must have controlled for that reasonably well. So lots of questions about the methodology. I guess the point being that perhaps those differences are not quite so great. Like, it's not like, all men are rapists and all women are victims. And I guess I've is this example relevant? Pausing because I feel like I'm harping on this topic a lot and I'm just uncomfortable with the material just because it's an uncomfortable topic.
But you can maybe check it in and you can always erase it if you need to.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I like that. But it's also stuff that needs to be spoken about. I'm thinking about for about 6 years of my life, I was a sex worker, which was mostly in the realm of felt to be more like therapy where touch was possible as opposed to traditional sex work, but all forms of sex work are valid. But I'm thinking about a friend I know, and this is not a criticism on her because I think the work she does is exceptional. I think it is spectacular. However, she often works with clients, and if she feels called in a particular direction, she will often use drugs for her clients and herself, marijuana mostly, but sometimes other things as part of the session. And if things move in that direction, she'll move things towards unprotected penetrative sex. And again, I don't pitch that as a criticism of what she's doing. I think she does it with a sense of ethics and conduct, and I can see some incredible benefit that comes from that. But if I were to do any of those things, any one of those things would get me chased out of town. I use that as an example to highlight. I just want to pick apart this notion, this sense of like women don't cause sexual harm and men do. Therefore, when women are more in power, these problems are going to go away. I think it is far more complicated, and we all have far more of the patriarchy in us than we would like to admit.
I've definitely seen circumstances where in the more sort of risque kind of settings, I've actually needed to ask a female to not attend because I didn't feel like she was slapping people's butts and stuff like that, which had she been male, everyone would have told her not to attend. But because she was female, it was, oh, isn't that funny? It's like, no, it's not funny. It's not, it's, yeah, it wasn't in my view. And, you know, I'm annoyingly addicted to fairness, and it just wasn't fair. I just went, no, you can't slap people's butts without their permission. And then being that the same person had had little dummy spits about men doing that to her at times, it's like, what are you even saying? Like, you do the same, the actual same activity.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I had to intervene once with someone that was similar circumstances, and when I gave them a little tap on the shoulder to say, hey, rein in your behavior, they turned to me and said, oh my God, you're slut shaming me.
Oh no.
So radically different perceptions. Yeah.
And I mean, I guess for me, it's, you know, the listeners don't know that for me, it's relevant to say I am a survivor of quite a lot of sexual abuse. So, and for me, it was at the hands of men, but, so it's not like I'm going, oh yeah, everything's equal. I don't think it's equal, but I think that's kind of the problem, that it's not like it's, I think it's far, far messier and more complex than we can just go, oh, well, it's all men's fault. I don't think we can do that. Well, I think that's part of the problem when we do that. And, you know, that's maybe for me why I was interested in being part of this podcast, is because it's like, well, this is very complex territory, but very interesting to me, and stuff that I think is so important to have to delve into and have to go, oh, that's uncomfortable and confusing, and I don't know where I stand on blah, blah, blah topic or whatever. I think it's really important that we look into those things, that we find out, oh, that's actually hitting me a bit hard. Hang on, what do I do with that one? Or, you know, maybe I've done that thing that we just discussed or whatever it is. Like, anyway,
you've just said it really well. You've managed to get to, I think, what I was hoping to get out of some of those examples, which is just to say, yes, it's complicated. It's really uncomfortable. Mm. And the gods know we're not denying patterns and trends and whatever. Mm. It's just, it's uncomfortable and it's complicated.
Mm. Yeah.
Speaking of which, and this is another bit that I have no idea whether it's going to make it in, because what I'm about to say grosses me out. But it's the question of women making better leaders than men.
Mm.
And again, there is no way to prove this. There is no data, and it's just impossible. But there are, I think, a lot of people who think that women are infallible. And in the course of making this podcast, doing the research for this, I've been putting together a list just as they've popped up in the media around me. And this doesn't prove anything, except if you think that all women are great leaders, and that's all there is to it, then this list is in contrast to that. So Margaret Thatcher more or less destroyed the social services and community fabric of the great nation of Britain in the 70s. Condoleezza Rice, according to many experts, was the security head that effectively pushed President George Bush to invade Iraq, giving rise to the uncomfortable idea that behind every bad man is a bad woman.
Mm-hmm.
Pauline Hanson has meandered into Australian politics with something of a regressive back to the 1950s approach to life, politics and policy. There'll certainly be no meetings starting with gender pronouns in her office. Australian mining magnate Gina Rinehart, now one of Australia's two biggest miners, showed us that women can rake the earth for minerals with dickful thinking just as good as any dude can.
Mm.
News of the World editor Rebecca Brooks showed us that women can hack phones, run scandals and lie about it just as well as any man can. Gail Kelly, the CEO of Westpac Bank in Australia, held up as a model of female leadership in corporate finance right up until she showed us that she was just as ruthlessly profit-driven as the last patriarch, and then censored social media and wider debate about it. Indira Gandhi was Prime Minister of India in the middle of the 20th century. She quickly centralised power, more or less destroyed the media and criticism, smashed Pakistan and created the mess that Bangladesh continues to grapple with. And in any case, in case anyone was still doubting her ability to lead like a man, she oversaw the forced sterilisation of 6.2 million men, which included thousands dying from botched operations. As a side note, it's funny how you don't get that one reported about as a war against men, which then makes it feel like there are no wars against men. If you ever want to do that thing where you sort of laugh and cry at the same time, then check out the women that ran the Osho community, which is not to say the men in that community were great. There was a great article on Mamma Mia about Nazi women. Aung San Suu Kyi narrowly won the leadership of Myanmar, and for a good few years was a legitimately shining example of how female leadership could be open, communicative, conciliatory and collaborative. up until it came out that unfortunately she'd been allowing the gradual removal of the Rohingya indigenous people, culminating in a massacre described by many as genocide. For another laugh and crying moment, look up Grace Mugabe from Zimbabwe, and also look up Madam Nu, that's N-H-U, who was the first lady of South Vietnam in the 1950s. Belle Gibson showed us how to use female charm, innocence and good looks to fleece us out of millions of dollars for her cancer. Problem was that the cancer never existed. Elizabeth Holmes then showed us she could do the same thing with the promise of avoiding cancer in the future in what might be the world's largest medical fraud ever. If you've ever wondered if a woman can get up to rape, slavery, murder and all of the trappings of life on the high seas, research the Chinese pirate queen.
That's good.
Ellen DeGeneres, I think that's how you pronounce it. For so long, the beautiful female face of male-dominated television, even more a point of liberation on account of her lesbianism, turned out to be a bully boss and abusive person to work alongside, like so many others in the sector. Park Geun-hye, sorry about the pronunciation, president of South Korea, impeached and 20 years jail for embezzlement. If you think that only Donald Trump is capable of doing Donald Trump, then have a look at his spokesperson from his first term, Kayleigh McEnerney. Mm. She shows us that lies and the ability to manipulate a whole country is not a gendered quality. Meanwhile, over in France, Marine Le Pen is from the far right and nearly won office in 2022. She's there to disprove any thoughts you might have that women are by default more progressive. Someone else rooting for the same cause is Marion Hammer, who is a National Rifle Association lobbyist that's caught on tape strategizing about how to repackage a bunch of school shootings so that the outcome will be more guns for everyone, not less. I understand she doesn't actually shoot guns herself, but just wants to do well in her very well-paying job. That right there, she is the cornerstone of patriarchal thinking, putting your economic interests ahead of ethics and other people's lives. Giorgia Meloni was an Italian right-wing, the first female prime minister, but just doing the same old right-wing shit. Gina Haspel was in line to be a female face of the CIA. Her application got snagged because it came out she oversaw torture and waterboarding of prison suspects and then destroyed the evidence. Oops. Griselda Blanco, maybe the only drug cartel boss that was so violent and so ruthless, she made Pablo Escobar, who's not generally known for his pacifism, scared. And lastly, there's the bonobos, who turn out to not actually be the peace-loving monkeys that they are generally portrayed as, despite being under a matriarchy. They rip each other to death and do all sorts of other violent things in the same way other monkeys do. So I hate that list. I hate going through it. I'm not saying that women are bad leaders. If anything, I actually still suspect that the opposite is true, if I've got a bias in any direction. Mm. And without a shred of doubt, diversity is better than no diversity. So whether you're looking at men and women or non-binary folks, a diversity of folks is always better. But yeah, I don't think that one's quite so clear cut. I guess I'm just responding to the song, if nothing else. I'd also possibly suggest that if women are better in those roles, in the same way that some men are better than some other men, that might be evidence of how they've been treated throughout their time. And I guess I just want to address a reaction that people have, which is sometimes to say that if you look at say, like that list that I've just read through, there's often a defense, which is to say those women are operating in a patriarchal system where the only way to survive is to behave in those ways. And that's kind of like, you know, not their fault. I kind of a little bit somewhat agree with that a little bit. However, if we let individual women off the hook for that, then we've also got to let individual men off the hook for that. Like the same thing has to apply. So I think that's messy territory.
Mm. Yeah, but the system is the problem. The system is a problem for everyone, not just women.
Yeah. So I want to finish up with the question of where to from here. Like, what are the actual answers going forward? What will be more useful? Because this has all been complaints and negativity so far this episode. I think when we use the word patriarchy, it's impossible to get away from the perspective of male predators and victors and female victims and innocents. And when we're thinking in terms of that model, we also tend to filter for that model, and we tend to see, you know, confirmation bias means that we tend to see evidence in support of that notion everywhere we look. But I think that since the issue at hand here is a question of power and use of power, misuse of power, then I actually prefer the word powerarchy. I think that's more to the point. To the best of my knowledge, I think I came up with that about 20 years ago, but I don't know that for sure. Others have suggested a word kyriarchy, which is spelled K-Y-R-I-A-R-C-H-Y. So it's just patriarchy, but kyriarchy is a non-gender specifier for a person. And I think either of those words, powerarchy or kyriarchy, they're right on point. They're more accurate because I think they allow for us being able to see those behaviours in people of all genders. So it makes it easier for us to spot the root problem. And they also recognise intersectionality. So just like as an example, if we're operating a model where it's patriarchy, where it's like men are looking out for all men and men are just absolutely privileged and that's all there is to it, then somehow we've got to pass, like somewhere there's a guy living under a bridge in, I don't know, insert extremely underprivileged country name here. I've recently been to Kenya, so let's just go with that, although that's one of the more powerful economic zones in Africa. But anyway, that person under a bridge has got more power than, say, you two or any of the women folk around me is just preposterous.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at things in terms of powerarchy, that reality can exist. I think a word like powerarchy or kiriarchy, like it allows us to look at the root cause, which is selfish behavior versus pro-social behavior. It also explains how only extremely hardened people make it to positions of power, like where the entire system at the moment only allows people with a, well, no. That's not to say that all people in positions of power have got an element of psychopathy or sociopathy to them, but it certainly favours those behaviour types into positions of leadership. And it helps us to focus on the misuse of power. I'm definitely not trying to argue that one side's got it worse or distract from women's issues. I think we need to look at what we're doing that creates selfish people and work on that. And if we limit ourselves to looking at the world and thinking about it as a patriarchy, we're missing the nuance and we're missing the gaps in what's happening with men that allows us to actually change those dynamics.
Yes, I totally agree with that. I totally think that it's far more to do with power and misuse of that, which I think is quite a social thing. I think, you know, I'm pretty in line with we inherited it and we haven't worked out how to be powerful with or around each other very well yet. And we haven't got many good examples. We haven't had that. And even, you know, me as a boss, I wasn't a particularly good boss, and it wasn't because I wasn't trying. I was just a shit boss. Like power was difficult and working it and managing it and all those things. And, you know, that's a tiny, tiny example of everyone in the world just wrestling around trying to find out how to work our power properly and not having particularly good tools for that.
Mm. On the other side, we also haven't worked out how to have checks and balances without stopping people. We haven't got a common goal and a common view of how we want to show up. So you have places where there is power that has checks and balances is effectively ineffective because they can't agree on basics. So we end up in places where we engineer things that have extreme power because the opposite model isn't working either.
A lot of the time I love what you're saying about we have checks and balances and they're actually incredibly good. And if you have any sensitivity and gentleness and openness about you, you'll get pulled down by those checks and balances at the first stage. So the only people that survive through that system to leadership is people who are somewhat immune to those checks and balances. They're just like, I don't care. Hello, Trump.
Yes, yeah, we had to get there eventually.
We did.
Being ruthless enough to just push through and steamroll people. That's like, yeah, I'm going to do it this way.
Yeah.
Everything breaks.
So I'm still fuck the patriarchy, but I think we're all part of the patriarchy and it's so much more complicated than that.
All you're asking is for a different social model. That's all. Is that too hard to ask?
So simple.
That's it. Let's just change that.
Yeah. I'm only asking to undo a million years of conditioning and
we just need to do it faster and less angry.
All right. Well, now that we've solved all of that, let's leave it there. And thanks so much.
All right.
And awesome. Thank you so much, Kane.